The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, today is Tuesday, March 20th, 2012. Let the record reveal we do have quorum. First on our agenda is Senator Chamberlain, House File 469. Senator Chamberlain. Welcome to the committee, Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my first time here.
This is your first time before the dreaded Senate Judiciary Committee?
That is, what I've heard, Mr. Chair, is dreaded where good bills come to die, but I hope these two do not.
Members, we all know how to make a first-time senator welcome in our committee.
We are ready.
Senator Chamberlain, please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, what we have here is a bill that was introduced last year. It has to deal with harassment restraining orders. It's trying to simplify filing for these orders by allowing the petitioner, the victim, to file in the county of residence or the county where the respondent lives. By doing that, you also clarify some of the rules and make it a little more consistent across the state and how the courts can deal with these issues.
Sir Chamberlain, can you pull that microphone just a little closer?
How's that, Mr. Chair?
I think that'll work. Thank you.
So what we're going to do is we have, as you said, House File 469. And with that brief introduction, I think I'll turn it over to the testifier to give you a few more details on the bill.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. NCASA provides technical assistance and support to over 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide. I'm very pleased to address the committee about this bill and hope I can provide information clarifying any questions you might have. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. As members of this committee are aware, sexual violence is a significant problem in Minnesota. According to the 2007 Minnesota Department of Health report, the cost of sexual violence in 2005, more than 61,000 Minnesota residents experienced sexual violence in some form. This number could nearly fill the Metrodome. Some victims of sexual assault seek civil protective orders from the courts to ensure that the perpetrator is barred from contacting the victim. Criminal penalties apply when such a court order is violated. One type of protective order that victims often seek is an HRO, a harassment restraining order, under Minnesota Statute Section 609-748. Before I go into any details about the bill today, I just want to give you a little bit of background about different types of protective orders. The orders that I'm going to discuss today in HRO are available in the civil court based upon a petitioner's request and a judge's determination of whether the request meets the statutory requirements. Please note that a criminal court can issue a no-contact order on its own initiative. Today's bill only addresses a particular type of protective order available through the civil court process. The harassment restraining order statute section states that a single incident of physical or sexual assault or repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another are considered harassment under that statute, and this applies regardless of the relationship between the actor and the intended target, and this is a very important distinction. An order for protection, which is available under Statute Chapter 518, looks at particular types of relationships. It applies when there is domestic abuse and there's a relationship between the parties that's familial or their household members. If a perpetrator of sexual assault is not related to the victim, does not live with the victim, and is either unknown or an acquaintance of the victim, then an OFP, an order for protection, would not be the available option, but an HRO would be the available option. At present, the HRO statute does not state where a petitioner for an HRO can file for relief, and this is what we're trying to address with the bill. This has led to inconsistent interpretation of the law statewide, translating into confusion for petitioners and the courts, delays in action, and compromised safety when a victim of physical or sexual assault or stalking needs protection. Some, including the chief judges of district courts acting in lieu of a statutory change, have interpreted the omission in the statute to indicate that the HRO should be filed in the same way as a civil order, other civil court filings. meaning that the petition can be filed only in a county in which one or more of the defendants resides or in which the cause of action arose. Other courts and attorneys have interpreted the omission to mean that the HRO petition can be filed in the same way as the OFP. And under the OFP statute, a petition can be filed in the county of residence of either party or in the county in which the alleged domestic abuse occurred. And there are no residency requirements that attach to an OFP petition. I'd just like to give you a brief example of why we're seeking this statutory clarification. An advocate from one of our member programs in southern Minnesota contacted us that a victim was sexually assaulted and she went to file for an HRO in her county. The court clerk instructed the petitioner that she had to go and file the order in the county where the sexual assault occurred. It was a different county. When she went to that county to make the filing, she encountered the perpetrator of the assault. He harassed her, and as you can imagine, that was a traumatic experience. So while I realize what happened, this particular victim is a bit unusual, that's not going to happen very often, it is important to point out that she still wouldn't have had this unwanted interaction if she hadn't had to go to that other county to file. Also, she had to travel a significant distance in order to do that filing. This is not maybe as much of an issue for victims who reside in the Twin Cities, but becomes a big barrier to victims who are living in greater Minnesota. Another part of the bill aligns the statutory directive for filing HROs petitions with the existing language for OFP filings. If this bill is enacted into law, an HRO petitioner can file for relief in the county of residence of either party or in the county where the harassment occurred, and there are no residency requirements, so essentially the same as the OFP. Since we believe that an HRO serves a similar purpose to the OFP, especially when physical or sexual assault or stalking is involved, this is an appropriate change in the law. HRO petitioners seeking protection deserve clear guidance from the statutes about where to file, and their safety is at stake. We need to remove any barriers if possible. You should also know that the bill does not include references to family court jurisdiction that are found in the OFP statute because the options for relief are different in the HRO statute than they are in the OFP statute. It's also less likely that HRO cases will involve any family law issues. The bill also updates the HRO statute fee waiver. The HRO statute waives filing fees for an HRO petitioner in certain circumstances, especially when there's an allegation of stalking or criminal sexual conduct. The OFP statute also waives fees in a similar manner. These filing fees ensure that petitioners have access to the court, that they are not barred from seeking protection just because of a financial reason. And also, federal law requires that the state, in order to be eligible for grants to combat violence crimes against women, must certify that its laws do not require a victim of sexual assault, stalking, or domestic violence to bear the cost of filing for a protection order. And we are currently in compliance with that. You'll recall that in 2010, there were some changes to the stalking law, and those additional sections that were added to the stalking statute are now added to the fee waiver in the HRO statute. So we're just reflecting some recent changes in the law. There are no new fee waiver categories created. We just want to make sure that cases that should be eligible for a fee waiver don't fall through the cracks, and we don't expect that this change is going to result in any increased HRO filings asking for a fee waiver. Just to sum up, MnCASA works to ensure that victims and survivors of sexual assault have the best possible access to the judicial system and the protections that it offers. This bill, we hope, will ensure the process of obtaining a harassment restraining order is as straightforward as possible for both the victims and for court employees. And we hope this will help to reduce any barriers to justice for individuals who have been harmed and therefore further public safety in the state. So thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Are there any questions for the proponent of the bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak against the bill? Do members have any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just make an observation that historically I think venue has been afforded in the county where the defendant resides or the cause of action or the event occurred, and it was historically that has been the case for the purposes of protecting the defendant against unwarranted lawsuits. This is different, and it seems to me entirely appropriate to allow the petitioner to bring this kind of an action in the residence or in the county where the petitioner resides for the same reason, for the protection of the petitioner. So I would indicate to members that I will be supporting this bill.
Senator Newman. I mean, Senator Harrington.
I know the resemblance is startling, but
it's almost as though you could be related.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's all. I also want to speak in support of the bill. This is language is very reminiscent to the wording that we've used for a long time in terms of telephonic harassment and other no contact orders there, where whether it was in the county of the victim or the perpetrator or where it was originated, you could take action in any of those. It allowed law enforcement to take investigatory action and enforcement action wherever it was most appropriate. And so I think this is a good piece of legislation. I think it will further protect women who are mostly the victims of this, but I think it's a good piece of legislation that will allow law enforcement and public safety to be able to take action where they're going to be most effective. So
any other questions? Hearing none. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none, Senator Newman moves House File 469 be recommended to pass and moved to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Chamberlain, your next bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer.
Be right back,
House File,
Mr. Chair.
House File 1835. Welcome back, Senator Chamberlain.
Glad to be back, Mr. Chair.
We're still counting this as your first day before the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, then this one is substantially more difficult than the last. What we have here, Mr. Chair and members, is a bill that was an idea that was brought forward by Sheriff Stewart sitting to my left. We like good ideas. It saves some money and some time for the counties and for him as well. It simply deals with colors of sheriff's cars, and that'll save them some money and time. So with that, I'll let Mr. Sheriff Stewart, he's got a brief presentation. He'll go through this.
Welcome to the committee, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is James Stewart. I'm the sheriff of Anoka County. And as Senator Chamberlain indicated, we had some early conversations as, like you, we're trying to identify ways to improve our efficiencies and our overall operational effectiveness. And this was something that we identified, and I'll try to be very brief. I know your schedules are busy, and I appreciate your time. We're basically looking for your support to enact legislation to provide more flexibility in the law as it relates to sheriff's marked squad cars, specifically the colors. It became a focus for sheriffs due to the challenges created by the limited manufacturer availability of the mandated colors and the unnecessary expense to basically paint our vehicles every year. Our current law, Minnesota Statute 16998, does define rules for police, patrol, or security guard vehicles, and the statute requires that the squads shall have uniform colors and markings. Specifically, Subdivision 1 allows for flexibility for police agencies to have their vehicles be predominantly blue, brown, green, black, or white, where sheriff's vehicles currently shall be predominantly brown or white. The challenge then comes in for us in the manufacturer reality that between Chevy, Dodge, and Ford, there are five police packages available. Of those five police packages, only Ford offers brown. Additionally, they only offer it on the Interceptor packages, and so as agencies like ours have a lot of specialty units related to the specialty services we provide, dive, rescue, SWAT, whatever those may be. We have a lot of pulling units, and we have the vans and transport vehicles, things like that. And none of the specialty vehicles are offered in brown. And so what we find ourselves, that's kind of the common trend, not only with this year's state contract, but with past contracts. And so what we found in the Anoka County example is that we're getting three of those specialty vehicles every year outside of the standard cruisers, if you will, the sedans, and those might be those transport vans or specialty units. And as we get these brand new vehicles in off of the from the dealership, we could spend up to $7,200 annually to paint these brand new vehicles. And so we saw this as a potential area to improve our efficiencies and you know, be a little more fiscally responsible with those dollars. We typically have not even painted all of these vehicles as the cost could be too high, and sometimes we run the vehicles as unmarked to save on those costs. Unfortunately, the unmarked vehicle costs costs us more in taxes to actually put license plates on the vehicles, and it also has a negative impact on the public visibility and our professional presence within the communities that we serve. So as we worked within our office to improve efficiencies, this is a quick way we found that we could do that, and we reached out informally throughout the state of Minnesota, touched base with 15 other sheriff's offices, and I'll be brief through this, but in short, the findings were that there is a strong desire to add the additional color options as the money is being spent to paint new vehicles, or the fleets are not currently being utilized uniformly as mandated, or quite honestly, not everyone is finding it easy to be within compliance of the colors that are currently mandated. So in summary, we're requesting that gold and black be added as color options for the sheriff's marked squad cars. The vehicle manufacturers do limit our vehicle options as well as our color options without regard for any of the state mandates or the statutes that are currently in place. And many of the sheriffs feel that their hands are tied due to the more restrictive budgets that we're currently facing, and the manufacturers who do not review or have any consideration for current legislative mandates imposed to us prior to determining the vehicles that are available on their colors. The good news, the straightforward request brings no cost and requires no type of funding. And as yet, we have not identified or heard of any known opposition. And the additionally important from our side of it is it allows us to maintain that uniformity and ultimately maintain and promote our professional image within our communities. So I thank you for your time, your consideration, and certainly available should you have any questions.
Any questions? Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question. Is this going to have, I see that security vehicles are exempted from this. I'm wondering about campus police. Is there going to be any effect on campus police? Last year we had some conversation about that, and it was going to cause St. Thomas campus and some of the other not the U of M police, but other non-police campus authorities to have to change over their colors. Would this have any impact there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sure. Harrington. I'm not aware of any challenges being posed by that. I know the U of M is specifically called out by statute. I'm not aware of any challenges being posed to those.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Sheriff, how much does it cost to paint a brand new police car?
The sedans, we've been fortunate we haven't painted. The SUVs and specialty units, on average, we're looking at about $2,700.
So does that happen a lot in other sheriff jurisdictions?
Mr. Chair, it varies greatly from county to county. Again, the Anoka County example, typically we'll get three of these specialty vehicles per year. The couple of larger agencies may get more than that, and outstate they might only see one vehicle per year, but it's still an issue.
Okay. Sir Ambrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the years, this has changed a lot, back and forth, different browns, different this, different that, and for years I think it was kind of a standard we went with white, because we could get that from the company. It wasn't going to cost anything. If you wanted to paint the door or put a badge on the door, it would cost. But has there been any consideration at all? I know the police departments, it seems that they're going back to the black and white, the old tradition of black and white. Any condition? Any talk at all with the sheriffs about that?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think this affords us that luxury. The predominant color is what kind of opens it up. If a sheriff's office wants to be black and white, the predominant color is the way it's worded in the statute, and so this allows a predominantly black and then some white vehicle, or a predominantly black and or white and some black. So it opens up some flexibility. I'm not aware of any statewide push to move towards black and whites. I know there's been some discussion. To my knowledge, it's not in the hopper currently.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none, would Senator Ingebrigtsen move the bill?
I would move this bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves House File 469. Be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor. I'm on the wrong bill. I'm sorry. Let's amend that. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that House File 1835 be recommended to pass and move to the floor. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion does prevail.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Senator Chamberlain, could you tell all the other senators that we do pass bills in this committee? There seems to be a rumor going around. Next is Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senate File 2125.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2125 deals with the possession of and sale of firearm silencers. And with me today, I have a couple of witnesses that can testify with regards to the bill. How the bill came to me was through Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson was asked, I believe, that I do this, and because I would assume that I know something about silencers coming from the law enforcement background that I have. Frankly, we didn't deal a whole lot with silencers in my business. The chief might have some different experience with this. I don't know, but I know since I recently came to the Senate, I know that the DNR certainly does deal with silencers when they are actually exterminating or taking out different critters and different animals that are problematic, and without it disrupting the public or giving it a lot of attention. Specifically, I think, and maybe these gentlemen here can tell me one way or the other, but cormorant has been a problem throughout the state of Minnesota, and I know they do exterminate cormorants with the aid of silencers. But what this particular bill does, Minnesota law prohibits the sale and possession of silencers by civilians, the only exception being for certain police and wildlife management purposes. The bill would create another exemption to the Minnesota prohibition. It would allow federally licensed firearm importers, manufacturers, and dealers to possess silencers for the purpose of selling or otherwise transferring the devices to the chief executive officer of any state or local governmental unit, or to the officer's designee for the purpose of tactical emergency response or wildlife management operations. This section is effective the day of the following enactment, as it shows on the bill. So, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I do have an A1 amendment that was that staff has put together. I'd like to offer it at this time if I could.
Do the members have an A1 amendment? It's being passed out now. Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you describe the amendment?
I'm going to use the services of Mr. Backus, if I could, right. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Backus, could you describe the amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment's basically a clarifying or technical almost amendment in that under current law, in addition to the individuals that Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned, collectors can possess silencers under certain circumstances. So by the A1 amendment, just basically guards against a potential interpretation of the law that would prevent that. So it's really anticipating a potential problem and trying to make sure that doesn't occur.
This amendment is an author's amendment. It seems to be technical in nature. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have today, who wants to be first?
I can. And
Chris Stafford, and then
Ken Fagerlund.
Ken Fagerlund would like to testify to start with. Thank you.
Will you identify yourself for the record, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Council committee members. My name is Chris Stafford. I live at 904 Bucknell Boulevard Southeast in Stuartville, Minnesota. I'm a licensed firearms dealer as well as a manufacturer. And my interest in this bill is because I work closely with the Sheriff's Department, and I'm trying to expand that work to other departments in providing them with equipment and suppressors. In the past, when I have done this for the Olmsted County Sheriff's Department, they had to take and make a purchase on my good word as to the product itself, because there's no way for me to bring a product in and demonstrate that to them show them how it would fit on their firearm, whether or not it would make a point of impact difference on the shot being fired, how it would go on their tactical vest, etc. They actually simply had to take my word that the product was a good, valid product. And fortunately for me, thus far, they've taken that word. But I would like to be able to expand my operation and deal with other departments, be able to bring in other equipment to demonstrate to them as time goes on to make sure it's worthy of the taxpayer's dollar. I relate it to kind of like buying something on eBay versus being able to walk into a local retail store and picking it up and touching it and feeling it and see how it fits on your foot if it's a shoe. When you buy something sight unseen, you can end up disappointed, and it could be a big loss on taxpayers' dollars, whereas if we could bring in dealer samples from different manufacturers and actually let them use them on the target range, see how it affects the firearm, see how the decibel reduction would be for safety reasons and for flash purposes dealing with they were entering into a premises where there could possibly be chemicals, a meth lab, for example. Shots are fired. If you have a flash off the end of a barrel, you could ignite that premises, where a suppressor not only reduces the decibels so that their hearing is not as affected and not having a work comp issue, but it also changes the flash signature and you have less flaming out of a barrel. So again, there's a lot of uses for it, especially for the entry teams. As far as the DNR usage in southeastern Minnesota where I preside, they had to eradicate a lot of deer. There was a concern of chronic wasting, where I believe they eliminated about 2,100. They did this during early hours of the morning, evening hours, and of course in areas that was populated by residencies. And it's an issue, again, where they're trying to eliminate that sound signature and not disrupt people in the area. So for us, it would simply allow us to bring them in for demonstration purposes, to possess them so we could demonstrate them to different sheriffs and DNR departments, make a positive sale on their behalf, and use a taxpayer's dollar in an appropriate manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stafford. And would you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Ken Fagerland, and I'm also a firearms manufacturer from the Rochester, Minnesota area. And I guess Chris pretty well summed up what we'd like to do. We'd like to be the ones to demo these suppressors to the police departments ourselves. You can't show them a picture and expect them to buy the suppressors. So I guess that's our main goal.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak against the bill?
Mr. Chair, he has another comment.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Chris Stafford. I have been in touch with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I had the opportunity to speak to Mr. Jim Franklin, the executive director. He said that the Sheriff's Association has viewed the wording of this bill and they have no opposition. And he gave me the liberty to say that I did speak to him personally and there was no opposition on their behalf. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak against the bill or for the bill? Please come to the table.
I have in my, Mr. Chair, I have in my witness list Neil Koenig. I believe that's who this
Koenig?
Is.
But yeah, that would be me.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm very poor in names. People don't have a problem with my name at all, but I have trouble with everybody else's. Thank you.
Was it Mr. Koenig?
Yes, please.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Mel Koenig. I run a company called JP Enterprises, JP Rifles, up in Hugo, Minnesota. Do you want me just to keep running on
sure,
and on?
Sure,
go
right
there...
ahead.
Okay,
we're
all right.
When we get tired of you, we'll cut you off.
You'll give me the high sign? Okay, I understand that. We're a woman-owned business here in Minnesota. We've been in business for 20-plus years. We build the absolute best gas-operated gun you can buy in the world today. We're very proud of what we do. Our business has expanded dramatically in the military and law enforcement communities. In fact, when we were testifying before the House, there was an alarm clearing where the chamber was cleared, everything left. The people that would have showed up would have been St. Paul SWAT. They carry our rifles. If you fly out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, their rapid response team carries our rifles because they clearly we want our people to be armed with the best. Our particular guns are gas-operated, and the gas signature changes when you attach a suppressor. How we tune that rifle is completely determined on being able to use a suppressor. Now, we supported an initial bill in the House that was narrower in scope than this, but I would support this because I can live with this. It's broader than what I need. What I need to be able to do to compete on national and world contract is be able to have a suppressor in-house that I can tune the gun with and verify that that gun is set up, ready to run, adjusted for that particular suppressor. That's critical to what we do and to who we supply. Again, we do build, and it's widely regarded, we build the very best in the world. We want to keep doing that. Now, my other option, about 18 months ago, we bought a building in Hugo, Minnesota, gutted it, rehabbed it. We've already outgrown it. We're contractually obligated to build a number of rifles that are complete systems. Either we need to move that, either we're going to buy the building that's directly across the parking lot from us, which is the twin to our building, and expand there, or we need to move it 10 miles away into Wisconsin, where it's legal for me as both an individual and a corporation to own a suppressor, and all my problems go away. I will speak from a personal, I've got a 52-mile commute each day from Minnetonka to Hugo. I do not need another 15 miles to get into Wisconsin, because my wife clearly thinks the world ends at the Mississippi River and doesn't start again until Chicago. So that's a personal issue for me, but I should meet her. It's entirely in your guys' hands. I've got to be able to deliver to a contract that I've already accepted and we've been pursuing for the last 18 months on being able to be granted an exemption to have a suppressor to test with inside of the state. I need the exemption or I need to move the business. And we are hiring between one and two new people a month. We're a great small business. We're a great employer. We have full medical benefits. We have 401K. We're just a very good employer. And I would really like to keep that in Minnesota, but I have no option. If I don't get an exemption where I can't have a suppressor to test the rifle with, I need to be able to move.
Mr. Koenig, would this proposal satisfy your needs?
Yes, it would go beyond what I need. I have a narrower scope, but this would be acceptable to me.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the testimony and am curious about what protections there are in the bill if a licensed dealer would actually use the silencer. I understand this bill is giving them permission to transport it to a place and then use it in the sale or in the demonstration of it. But what if, is there a protection, like if they were to suddenly be driving along the road and see something that they feel needs attention and then they use it not in the sale of it? Could if counsel or someone could just point out to me where we're protected from that type of behavior?
Senator McGuire, so if they're driving along the road and think something needs to be shot,
yeah.
Why don't we ask counsel if you could perhaps answer that question.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, if you look at paragraph D of the bill, it attempts to make it clear that there's no intention to allow these for personal usage. If they were to go beyond the scope of paragraph C of the bill, then the current felony would apply. That's a 2-year felony for a person who sells or has in possession any device used to silence or muffle the discharge of a firearm. So that felony would be applicable.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification. I was just reading. It says, for the purposes and uses expressly authorized under paragraphs A and B, and so I just got a little concerned because under A and B it says these can be used for purposes of emergency response and everything. So I was worried that it was referencing two sections that I wasn't sure we should be allowing them to do. So I shouldn't be concerned about that. I'm in reading in the construction of this bill because it says to the officers designated state in writing for the purposes and uses expressly authorized under paragraphs A and B. So I just.
Would that be correct, counsel?
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, yes, I think the paragraph C, the authority for these manufacturers, et cetera, to possess the silencer is limited to this type of sale to the people who are mentioned in A and B. And then I think those other provisions would kick in if they went beyond it.
Okay, so thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So my concerns are dealt with in this bill as far as you're concerned, Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair. Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
The witness has got a couple things he'd like to comment about.
Mr. Stafford.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In respect to the use, again, the sale is no civilian sales. It's strictly for use for the police and or DNR. We would not be making individual sales. So our handling of those would be in demonstration purposes as supplying to two different agencies, and there'd be no sales to any type of individuals. Yes, we would have to demonstrate them. But pulling off roadside and making a shot, the suppressor would not be the issue at that point. It would be making that shot, which would probably be an illegal act in itself. And the suppressor would really not have a play in that act. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Sarah Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Backus, on line, it'd be the end of line 2.8, beginning of 2.9, it says that the sale can be to a chief executive officer of state or local government unit. The government unit we're talking about at that point is law enforcement and DNR enforcement officers. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, that's my interpretation. And again, if you keep on reading, for the purposes and uses expressly authorized under those two paragraphs. So I think that further narrows it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Backus.
Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I think my question may be similar to that, and I think Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen can probably answer that. It says here that in one point, in Section B, that talks about wildlife area manager or an employee designated or a person acting under contract, and I was wondering if you could clarify what that language refers to.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Yes, and we did have some discussion about this. I'm not sure if it was here last year or not, Senator, but yes, it would be somebody that would be either his designee or contract, and I think the DNR does contract some of these services. I might be saying something out of school here on that one, but I believe
they
do it at different times.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I believe the contract, where they say a contract personnel, again, in southeastern Minnesota, when they had to get rid of some of our deer population, they hired professional snipers to come in, professional shooters, to harvest those animals, and they were allowed to use that kind of equipment. So I'm assuming they'd be contracted by the DNR from that previous transaction, or by a sheriff's department. And other designees under the sheriff's department, if the chief law enforcement officer himself was not allowed to sign, the chief deputy oftentimes will sign acquisition documents and papers to acquire new equipment for the department. They have in the past some new dealings with the department. One other thing, if I may indulge for one more moment. If we look at our country as a whole, 39 states in the United States of America right now allow their citizenship to own suppressors. Of the remaining 11 states, 6 of them allow dealer manufacturers like myself, Mr. Fagelin, and the gentleman, Mr. King, behind us, to possess them for sales to law enforcement departments. So we're not broadening a scope that hasn't already been looked at. There's 45 states that readily already do this, such as the state of Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota. So thank you very much.
Follow-up questions?
Yes, Senator Harrington.
And having taken possession of St. Paul PD has had silencers and muzzle flash reduction for a number of years. We used for tactical operations, and so I'm familiar with the product, and I'm familiar with having to sign the documents that allowed us to take possessions of them. In that case, they were always only used by licensed peace officers, specifically trained and authorized under that category. My one question with this. Allowing contract folks to do is how the possession then would be handled. So is DNR issuing them, and then is there a control mechanism that they are checked out and then returned to DNR? How does that happen? That was really the secondary part to my question.
Mr. Chairman, I don't actually know that the answer to that question. I do know that there has to be a chain of possession that has to take place. They're very heavily federally regulated. as you know. You get them on a Form 5 when they transfer into a department. It would have to be under this explicit direction of that leader of that unit of that department. So,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions, Senator Martin?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, on that point, I actually carried the bill a number of years ago that gave the DNR the authority to do it. They were originally concerned about the cormorant problem and trying to one shot and they'd all flee, of course.
Yeah.
And so so they did that, and then they came back a couple years later to allow contract employees doing it, and the language in here was designed to make sure that the commissioner was in effect in control of them. They'd give them the contractor, but I don't know what's happened because I think, as you mentioned, a lot of police departments apparently do it for deer population and so on. And I don't know what happens in those communities. Is the police chief the one who keeps them and gives them to the contractors who are they're using to...
Mr. Chairman, I cannot vow for each department. Senator Harrington might best be able to answer that, but with the fact that under federal regulation, once they are assigned to that department, there is a possession change that has to take place, and that does have to be recorded. They do not allow; they're not allowed to keep them, and they're under specific use and purpose. So I'm assuming, again, there would be that possession record. Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Ritson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Marty and Harrington, I will get back to you with that information, how the DNR, how that chain of possession does. We talked about it last year, and I don't recall exactly the conversations. I know the colonel was here talking about that, and I certainly would do that.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none, Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate file 2125 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
As amended, Mr. Chair.
Oh, as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Senator Dames, and today I have Senate File 1875 to bring in front of you. Senate File 1875 deals with guarantee fund notice requirements. It also deals with proof of insurance cards and the distribution thereof, and also deals with the acquiring of accident reports. Mr. Chair, under Section 1, I do have an amendment that I would request to be passed out and approved.
Do you have a number on the amendment?
It's Senator? The A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
The A3 amendment will be passed out. Oh, it's already in our packets.
And when we had the hearing at the Commerce Committee, the Commerce Department had some concerns about the wording on line 1.14, page 1, under the notice requirements. And so at that time, we stated that we would work with the Commerce Department to come together with some language that everybody would be happy with. And so this amendment brings the language forth that has been agreed to by all the participants in this bill, including the Commerce Department. And what it states is that it was the Commerce Department felt that the notice requirement that we were asking for was too broad, so this narrows it down to the notice for the Minnesota Guarantee Fund can be done at the time of the sale for telephone sales, or it can be done at the time of delivery in written form at the time the policy is delivered.
Is this, Senator, is this at the point of sale of an insurance contract? What is the product that
this would be at the point of sale, and currently it's required at the point of sale. When you do a telephone sale, it gets to be a long process. And so what we're finding is a lot of people are just not paying attention, and they're really not even hearing about what the guarantee fund and what it does. So we've requested that we have on a telephone sale that we can mail that out with the policy by the company providing the policy. They would mail out a written form with the policy to the policyholder, so they would actually receive it at the time they receive their policy at the point of sale.
All right. Is there any questions on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Latz.
Senator Dames, what is the notice that's involved here?
Senator Dames.
And I'm going to ask Doug to clarify that.
Doug, could you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Doug Franzen. I'm here on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers of America. We support this bill. We also very much support the inclusion of language, which was drafted by the Commerce Department. The notice we're talking about is the notice of the existence of the Minnesota Guarantee Fund. It simply it gives consumers notification that the state has a guaranteed fund. It makes no representations about the companies, about the financial condition of any company. And in fact, the guarantee fund won't say that. So it's a very long, cumbersome, legalese way to say that if for any reason your insurance company goes insolvent, there is a mechanism, a guarantee fund, run by the state of Minnesota. Now, unfortunately, they take about four paragraphs, and it takes about 3 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes to read that communication to someone over the telephone. And as Senator Dames had mentioned, the comprehension, at least my comprehension, is not such that it's an effective notice. We believe, and I believe the Commerce Department now believes, that this indeed is effective notice. This also tracks the Life Guarantee Fund, but it is simply notice of the existence of the Minnesota Guarantee Fund.
Senator Latz, is that satisfying?
Yes, thank you. That's helpful. Mr. Franzen, is there any obligation then on the telephone salesperson to in some way notify the person at the time of the proposed sale that there exists a guarantee fund and they will receive a more detailed written notice to that effect with their insurance contract in the mail?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, no, this whole issue of the guarantee fund notice has been tossed around the Commerce Committee for a number of years, most notably to modernize it. Initially, you had to give the notice within X days by mail delivery, and then the legislature changed, I believe it was last year or the year before, to change it to you give the notice in the medium in which you make the sale. So if you go to an agent, the agent will hand you one. If you do it very over the internet, you say you click here and a notice comes up and you pretend you read it and then you click the button. The problem is with telephone sales, but there is nothing in the law, and I don't believe there has ever been anything in the law that requires a separate, you're going to get a guarantee fund notice, look for it when you get your policy or look through it in the mail. Quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, when we presented this issue in Commerce, we were of the strong opinion that a guarantee fund notice that it's there, which indeed is there for every policy sold in Minnesota, is not crucial to that decision-making whether to buy in a policy or not. Rather, it's information that's valuable to have, and I believe it was our assertion, which was accepted by the Commerce Department and the Commerce Committee, that the most effective delivery time that you can actually look and get the most out of reading the notice is when you get your policy delivered. That's the time until you may have a claim, that's the time you pay the most attention ever to what's in your policy. So it's a long way of saying, no, there's nothing in the law that says, by the way, when you get your policy, you will get a guarantee fund notice.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Latz.
So, Mr. Franzen, you're representing to the committee here that the question that I just asked was, in fact, considered by the Commerce Committee, and the Commerce Committee decided that it was not necessary or valuable or appropriate to require notice at the time of sale.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Franzen.
Senator Latz, boy, I'm real tempted to say yes, and here's why. At the time, the state of the law currently, prior to this bill, requires notice at the time of sale. for property casualty, not for life, but for property casualty. The whole purpose of this bill is to come forward and say that is not the most effective time. It's at the time of delivery that it is the appropriate time to deliver that notice. To the extent we made the argument, and the Commerce Committee accepted that argument by unanimous vote, I believe, wasn't it, Senator? I believe it was unanimous vote. I can say yes. But to the extent was the question ever posed specifically as you raised it, the answer would be no. Because that was the overarching point of the bill, and the committee did unanimously support that point.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, my recollection is the same way as it's done in life and health on telephone sales there, where this language would basically be the same as what it's done in life and health sales by telephone. And also this notice does require, or this amendment does require the person offering the policy shall document the fact that the notice was given. So I do think there is, I understand your concern, but as stated earlier, all policies are going to be backed by the guarantee fund. So whether the person is told at the time of sale or receives it with the policy really shouldn't be that, I don't see it that's that big of an issue, because they're getting the notification, and as Mr. Franzen said, that notification would not come in, the results of the notification would not come into play until you had a claim and the company you insured with was out of business. That's the first that you'd be using the guarantee fund. So the notice would be there long before that. I think the main thing is that we need to be cognizant, we need to get the notice out there. And personally, I think, coming from the insurance industry for 25 years, I think that the notice is going to be received better on a telephone sale coming with the policy than it is being listened to over the phone after you've just went through probably 15, 20, 25 minutes of information exchanged back and forth. I think by the time you get to this, it's just kind of blurred over.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Sir Letts.
Just a last thought, which is, I assume this is not typically a question before the Judiciary Committee. This is more a question for Commerce Committee, I would assume, unless I'm otherwise corrected. And my only frustration, I guess, is that we're being asked to do the work of the Commerce Committee here instead of them cleaning up their own bill before sending it to Judiciary, which is a bit of a frustration, being asked to weigh in on policies that we are not quite as familiar with in this committee. But that's more a comment than anything that needs a rebuttal.
Sir Dames.
Mr. Chair, just for point of clarification, when this left the Commerce Committee, I had agreed that we would work with the Department of Commerce to come up with language that was acceptable. I realize that this is probably not in the realm of the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. However, I did request that this amendment be heard here, because my philosophy is that this could have just went to the floor. But my thoughts are, when we have an agreement, that it's in our best interest to clean the bill up and get in presentable fashion on the floor that's going to be the bill that's going to eventually be heard there. So I'm the one that did request for the amendment to be heard here, and that's why I requested that.
Senator Dames, did you say that the Department of Commerce has approved this language as well?
That is correct. It's actually their language.
All right. Any other discussion on the amendment? Yes. Senator Newman, would you move the amendment?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Is this going to the floor from here?
Oh, we're just moving the amendment.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Newman moves the A3 amendment.
I do so move.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr.
Dames,
Chair,
do you have further testimony?
Yes. Mr. Chair, under Section 3, Subdivision 13, when it comes to requesting accident reports, I think that's probably where this committee has the most interest. And what we're doing there is we're asking that we can get the accident reports. Currently, the individual in the accident has to sign an order for the insurance company or their attorney to get the report. we're asking to have it so that the insurance company or the people that actually represent the person that was in the accident can get those reports without the signature. The Department of Motor Vehicles, they have felt that in order for them to do this, that they would put in a rule stating that if the insurance company was going to go ahead and request an accident report, that they would require the insurance company or the representing attorney, they would require them to have a notary fill out their request for information and then have that notarized. We do have an amendment to clean the language up just a little bit, and that is the A4 amendment.
Our packets. The A4 amendment is being passed out.
In what the A4 amendment does, Mr. Chair, is on line 2.22 on page 2, it removes involved in the accident and then just puts as described in section 1 and 2. And again, we remove that language on line 24. It clears up the language dealing with the request.
Ms. Pontius, could you give a further explanation of the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, I had a conversation with Mr. Franzen earlier this morning because I was looking at the bill and at the current law. It seemed to me that under the current law, the reference that you see on the bill on page 2, lines 22 and 24, that both the person involved in the accident or someone who was injured but not involved in the accident, which is item 2 above there, could get access to the accident report. And that's why I thought it would make sense to delete involved in the accident and just insert described in item 1 or 2. You can see that the current law is on the back page of your summary, and it isn't a model of clarity in terms of how it's drafted right now. It's a run-on sentence that goes on as a whole paragraph, essentially. But that is how I read the current law.
Ms. Pontius, since we're already referring in the amendment to subparagraph 1 and 2, and since it's already there, why do we even need it? Directive to go there. If we just took the word of a person involved in the accident, if we just omitted that, wouldn't 1 and 2 be sufficient?
Mr. Chairman, you need it has to be the legal counsel of one of those of somebody in 1 or 2,
I see.
Or the a representative of their insurance company. So it ties back to them.
I understand now. Okay. Is there any other question on the A4 amendment? Hearing none, Senator Newman moves the A4 amendment.
I shall move.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Dames?
And Mr. Chair, at this point, I would like to have Mr. Franzen explain more about the request and also Mr. Rusted from the American Family. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Franzen?
Mr. Chairman, members, Doug Franzen again. This bill, this is Section 3, Judiciary Jurisdiction, before today came in, which would be what we believe is pro-consumer, and take away obstacles to consumer hassle and delay claim payments. What has come out thus far today with the amendment you just adopted was something that brings greater clarity and succinctness to the law. And as Senate counsel pointed out, you see the law before this bill. I would respectfully submit that after the work that has been done on this, if you pass this bill and if we're fortunate that it's enacted into law, it will be more clear, more readable, and better for the general public. The substantive issues addressed is simply gives the attorney for an injured party or a property owner and the insurance company direct access to the motor vehicle, the accident report. From the insurance company's perspective, the company has a right to it anyway. Under all of our insurance policies, there's a duty for cooperation. And frankly, if there is an accident report, the insurance company will not settle the claim without it. They have a right to it. This eliminates the delay by getting direct access from the department. When we called the department to present this issue, the question was asked, why is it structured this way in Minnesota? And the best answer they could come up with is the legislature makes us do it this way. It's the only state in the country, to our knowledge, that has this fairly convoluted process. So we believe if the attorneys for the injured people in an accident and the insurers can get direct access, we can settle claims quicker. We can remove hassle from our customers and clients. Mr. Chairman, this seems like a fairly straightforward, common sense proposal. It has been vetted through one committee. We've worked with both the Commerce Department and DVS. We are aware of no opposition. And actually, Mr. Chairman, after the amendment we saw today, I'm very grateful that you chose to bring this into this committee, because I think we're coming out of this committee, if we're so fortunate to come out, with a better bill. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. Senator Dames, you had another witness or testifier?
Yes. Also, I have Mr. Dan Rusted from American Family. Dan?
Mr. Rusted, would you identify yourself for the record?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Dan Rusted. I'm a branch claim manager for American Family Insurance. We handle primarily property and casualty claims in the territory I work with. And this was an idea that surfaced about a year and a half ago as a result of coming to the state and seeing the hurdles that we were faced with in dealing with our insureds and investigating their auto accidents in a timely fashion. The question was raised. Senator Dames came to our rescue. That's it in a nutshell.
All right. Is there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Senator Newman moves House File 469 as amended. Oh, I am still on that 469. Aren't I? Late in the game, Senator Newman.
Get my motion right.
Senator Newman moves Senate File 1875 be recommended to pass as amended and proceed to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Letts. Senator Letts, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is this your first time before our committee?
Only if you judge my conduct.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1657 will add to the definition of qualified domestic violence-related offenses a violation of the female genital mutilation statute or crime. The qualified domestic violence related offenses are used to enhance penalties for a number of other crimes as described in your summary, including violations of orders for protection, restraining orders, no contact orders, stalking, and domestic assault and fifth degree assault. The idea was proposed to me by Jason Hutchison, who appears with me, a prosecuting attorney for the city of Hopkins. And so in a moment, I will ask him to explain the basis for the proposal. But I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment that I ask the committee to adopt as an author's amendment. And I can explain the difference between.
Okay. Senator Latz moves an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A1 amendment, well, the bill as originally drafted applied only to the female genital mutilation crime as committed against a family or household member, rather than including non-family or non-household members, other members of the community. And upon further consideration, we determined that there was not sufficient reason to draw the line at the family or household member, that it was appropriate to apply it in all circumstances. And thus you have the delete everything amendment that's just been adopted. So I'd ask the committee to consider the remarks from Mr. Hutchison.
Mr. Hutchison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Jason Hutchison, and that's H-U-T-C-H-I-S-O-N. I'm the prosecuting attorney in and for the city of Hopkins, Minnesota. And that's a position I've held for about the last 8 years now.
Sir, could you pull the microphone real close?
Be happy to. Normally people are telling me to be quiet, but it's nice to have this for a change. Would you like me to re-identify myself?
No, that's fine.
Okay. As prosecuting attorney for the city of Hopkins, I am primarily responsible for prosecution of adult misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor, domestic assault, order for protection, harassment restraining order, and other sort of related crimes. When I'm reviewing police reports to determine what level of charge to bring against the defendant or whether it's possible to enhance it to a felony based on prior convictions, the first thing we do is, in fact, look for prior convictions. In July of 2011, we had an instance where there was a troubling domestic assault with conduct between a husband and wife, and the gentleman was in jail, and we were trying to figure out whether or not this was going to be in my wheelhouse as a gross misdemeanor based on a prior conviction or whether it was going to be sent to the county attorney's office for felony prosecution based on a prior conviction. Based on sufficient prior convictions. One of his prior convictions was for female genital mutilation, which is a felony under Minnesota law, and he'd been convicted of that in, I want to say it was 2002. And that was interesting because it's the first time I'd seen that on a criminal history, and it caused me a great deal of trouble. And in fact, the detective is the one who brought it to my attention. And he said, but I don't think we can use this as a qualified domestic violence-related offense. And I said, oh, come on, we have to be able to use that. That's exactly the sort of thing we'd like to be able to use to make crimes more serious as a conviction of this nature. Well, after we reviewed the list of qualified domestic-related offenses, we realized that we could use certain assault cases, murder, sexual assault cases, but we were not able to use the female genital mutilation conviction on this gentleman's record to enhance the crime to send it off for more serious punishment. And at that point, we decided that the appropriate thing to do is not to let this little incident die in our office, but rather to contact Senator Latz and see whether or not there was any interest in the legislature in simply amending the list of qualified domestic violence-related offenses to add this. And we're here today.
Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, I hope that we would move this bill. I think it's very important. And you note on the list of qualified domestic violence-related offenses, it includes making terroristic threats or stalking. I think this clearly would qualify within the realm of what we're trying to look for repeat offenses. I hope members will support this.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Sarah Harrington?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just want to echo Senator Ortman. With a significant Somali population, East African population on the east side, this is an issue that has come up repeatedly in discussions with women's groups there and the religious organizations there and community groups, and it is very definitely something that I can support.
Sarah Latz, do you move Senate File 1657 as amended?
I do, and I ask that it be referred to the floor. I'm not aware of any other committee that has requested it.
Sarah Latz moves Senate File 1657 as amended and moved directly to the floor.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
is this the type of bill that could go on the consent agenda?
Any concern with that?
Mr. Chair, I would amend the motion to send this bill to the consent agenda.
Senator Ortman moves Senate File 1657 be recommended to pass or amends the motion proceed to the consent calendar. This is an amending Senator Latz's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Latz, we have the motion before you.
I have nothing further to
add. As amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. There's no further business before the committee. We stand adjourned.